En primer lugar, mis padres fueron asesinados, mi
The biggest
comunidad,
motivation
mis
of why
hermanos.
I left is that my parents were assassinated.
Nueve
Out of nine brothers
hermanos
that we were, only three of us
por lo
remained alive.
tanto,
My entire community was destroyed, and it was very important for me to come out with this information and denounce it internationally.
Fue una de las motivaciones más grandes. En realidad, en estos últimos tres meses, según los cálculos, los promedios en Guatemala, han habido 80 casos de secuestros y asesinatos por mes, o sea, de los últimos tres meses.
In the last 3 months, we have an average of 80 kidnappings and assassinations per month in Guatemala.
En primer lugar, yo creo que es muy peligroso.
Up to now, the supply of weapons to Guatemala has come from Israel. Obviously, the United States was involved, but essentially Israel was the main supplier of weapons to Guatemala. All of a sudden, the fact the United States is willing to appear very openly linked to the Guatemala military and to the policies of Guatemala military marks a worrisome new period. You must remember that there's a lot of forces active in Guatemala. For instance, Guatemala has an armed internal conflict which is growing and challenging the military. That the popular organizations and the mass movement is also growing in terms of strength and their demands and their struggle.
The woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize will tell us about her country and the brutal government which the U.S. has supported for all these years. Right now, on Alternative Views. Rigoberta Menchú has been struggling for human rights and social justice for more than a decade in her home country of Guatemala. Her autobiography, written in 1983, has been translated into more than a dozen languages and has been recounted in song, film, and university classrooms. However, after she won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1992, the establishment media largely ignored, downplayed, or distorted her significance. But you're going to be able to see and watch her on this Alternative Views. We'll see the interview with her later, but now let's have some news stories which come to you from the Alternative Press.
Bill Clinton has asked all of us to, he won't say, he doesn't like the word sacrifice, they like the word contribute. Well, who's going to contribute? And how much? And where's that money going to go? There was an article in the Associated Press, the objective news service, where it said that Clinton's new economic plan will significantly, quote unquote, significantly increase the taxes on the wealthy. From 31% to 36%. Wow-wee. Well, let's take a look at this. In the Multinational Monitor for January and February, it has an article about some of this welfare for the rich that has been going on over the years. It says the largest government subsidies to big business are found in the tax code. In the 50s and 60s, the corporate income tax provided 25% of all federal government revenues. And I've seen other statistics which indicated that corporations paid up to 31, perhaps 33% of the tax bill at that time in the 50s and 60s. Now, on the average, during the 50s, the corporations paid about 67 cents for every dollar in taxes paid by citizens. But what happened in the 70s and 80s, etc.? Well, by the 70s, corporations were paying, instead of 67 cents, they were paying 31 cents for each public dollar. And in the 80s, This came in at 21 cents. All this meant that by 1991, only 7% of the government revenue came from corporations, down from at least 25%. So when the Associated Press says, oh, this is a significant raise from 31% to 36, we got to go back and see how it's been cut over the years. The Economic Tax Recovery Act of 1981, this was Reagan's big gift to CEOs and to the corporations and to the wealthy. It created the largest business tax reduction in history and virtually eliminated corporate taxes and provided a new system of write-offs for business investments. So we saw what all this did. We gave all this money to the wealthy and to the corporations. What'd they do? They squandered it on all kinds of bad investments and junk bonds, of capital flight to other countries, and to all kinds of speculative real estate ventures, and also looting the savings and loans institutions which we had in the United States. Well, what are some of these subsidies? We've given long lists of the total socialism for the rich, or welfare for the rich. The Multinational Monitor has a few of them here. It says at least $97 billion worth of subsidies over the last four decades have gone to the nuclear industry. And of course, who gets the profits? The nuclear industry, not you and I. The taxpayers foot the bill for costs relating to research and development and regulation, construction, and all this business, but the corporations get the profits. $76 billion worth of research and development at federal agencies, national laboratories, nonprofit universities, and other research organizations are paid for by the government, but then they turn the products over to private corporations who get the profits. Now, the management of 192 million acres of publicly owned forests by the U.S. Forest Service will squander over $1 billion each year on providing timber industry with below cost timber sales. Well, there's another one. There's a 1872 Mining Act, which allows companies to mine without paying a cent of royalties. Or they can also purchase public land for $5 an acre. And of course, this is an enormous windfall, not only for U.S., but also for foreign corporations. Well, the S&L bailout, we all know about that, up to $1 trillion. So there are many, many of these subsidies. Well, what about welfare for everybody else? Well, only $14 billion was allocated for aid to families with dependent children, and $17.3 billion for food stamps, $53 billion for Medicaid in 1991. But that pales by significance to the subsidies given to the rich and the powerful. So Bill Clinton asked for sacrifice. The real people aren't doing it. Reminds me of what Jesse Jackson said about 4 years, 5 years ago. He said, let the people who had the party pay for it.
The Year of the Woman. Does that sound familiar? Well, I think we can all remember how the media claimed 1992 was a revolutionary year for women in politics. Now, this appeared to hinge only on the record number of women running for office, not on the series of events that threatened the hard-won gains women have sought to achieve. From an October 1992 issue of Lies of Our Times, 1992 should be noted as the year when women's legal right to abortion was compromised, when the most chewed-on soundbite, family values, was really a euphemism for the motherhood, housewife, heterosexual mandate, when the Bush re-election campaign attacked single mothers through Murphy Brown, when Hillary Clinton was loudly proclaimed as a radical feminist, and when women candidates were finally considered viable, not because of qualifications and experience, but because as outsiders they could clean up the mess the incumbents had made. But let's look at the real numbers. While ignoring the issues, the mainstream media just focused on how many women were running and not interpreting these numbers. So let's figure out what they meant. Take the Senate. 8 women ran, 4 women won. 50%, not bad. But don't get too excited. In this issue, a Boston College study found that it projects that if half of all candidates in the upcoming elections are women, it will still take more than a century before Congress becomes half women. Putting it in perspective, women in the United States are still far more politically marginalized than their counterparts in Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. And even more surprisingly, we still rank far below Mozambique, Cuba, Vietnam, China, and Iraq. Seen in this context, the year of the woman fizzled out way before Election Day.
Flag City, USA. Flag City, USA.
Flags flap in unison.
Flag City, USA.
The yellow ribbons everywhere.
Flag City, USA.
Flags flap in unison. The yellow ribbons everywhere.
Have a more practical side.
The average family here earns $22,000 a year.
The county's unemployment rate is more than 10%.
What are their options in this day?
Flag City, USA.
Some people say it's patriotism that calls into arms.
Flags flap in unison.
The yellow ribbons everywhere.
Boys in this class say they'd be proud
to fight.
Flags flap in unison.
The yellow ribbons everywhere.
Some people say it's patriotism that calls them to arms.
Flags flap in unison.
The yellow ribbons everywhere.
All but one of the boys.
A human flag.
All but one of the boys.
A human flag.
Some people say it's
Flag City.
Flags flap in unison.
All but one of the boys.
A human flag.
Can I share a pet peeve with you? That is the pundits you see on television and hear on radio, and even some of the politicos who talk about tax and spend liberals, tax and spend Democrats. But let's stop and think about that. All governments tax and spend. Governments take in money for through taxes, and then they provide services of different types, so they spend it. So the key thing isn't whether taxing and spending is going on. The key thing is who is being taxed and how much. And then the second thing is where is the money going? Who is benefiting from the spending? So whenever you see these people on TV or hear them on radio saying, well, this is tax and spend, you say, hey, wait a minute. Who's benefiting? And who's having to contribute?
We'll have more news stories later, but now let's turn to the centerpiece of our program, the interview with Nobel Prize winner for 1992, Rigoberta Menchú Tum, a native of Guatemala.
Can you tell us why you left Guatemala?
¿Podría decirnos usted por qué salió de Guatemala?
Sí, en primer lugar, mis padres fueron asesinados, mi comunidad, mis hermanos.
The biggest motivation of why I left is that my parents were assassinated. Out of nine brothers that we were, only three of us remain alive. My entire community was destroyed.
And it was very important for me to come out with this information and denounce it internationally.
Who killed them?
El ejército. En realidad es que mi padre fue un hombre que luchó mucho por la tierra.
The army killed my parents, particularly my father was a leader of the community, involved in defending our cultural rights and our land rights, and because of that he was persecuted. But also because my land, or my village, is in what's called a zone of conflict, the army began to harass us more and more, to the extent that the massacres came and the persecution in that area.
And that was in 1980-81?
That was in 1980-81, en el 81-80.
Yo salí de mi comunidad en el finales del 79. El 80 fue quemado vivo mi padre en la embajada de España el 31 de enero. Y el año 81 yo salí al campo internacional.
I had to leave my own community in 1979. Then in 1980 my father was burnt alive at the embassy of Spain in the protest they had, and then in 1981 I had to leave the country and come to work internationally.
And now we have what's called a civilian government in Guatemala. Is it really a civilian government?
Hoy tenemos un gobierno civil en Guatemala. ¿Realmente es un gobierno civil?
Sí, en realidad Cerezo mismo dijo públicamente cuando tomó la presidencia que tenía el 35% del poder real. En los últimos años, especialmente el 11 de mayo, de este año, el ejército guatemalteco.
Even President Cerezo, when inaugurated, admitted publicly that he only had 35% of power. And the situation has deteriorated to the extent that the military have opposed him and staged in an attempted coup on the 11th of May, in which we know that there was 25 points that were negotiated by the government with the officers carrying out the coup. So if Cerezo had 35% of power when he came in, how much power do you think he may have left at this moment?
O sea que es en Guatemala en realidad el ejército tiene muchos años de historia de
The army has a long history of controlling power economically, politically and militarily. And that's not been altered. Cerezo has not changed that situation. On the contrary, it is the presence of Cerezo that has served the military to try to bring a new image, try to stay away from the image of the army that has persecuted and massacred the population to the image of a military that's moving toward democracy. But in the meantime, that same military is planning the new campaigns which are beginning now against the population.
O sea que es incluso ver en cosas muy básicas. En realidad no hubo ningún solo responsable de las masacres, de la represión y sobre todo la aplicación de la tortura en Guatemala, que haya sido castigado o enjuiciado en tiempo de hacer eso. O sea, ninguno solo.
We can see that with very basic facts. For instance, there has not been one single person tried and condemned for violation of human rights, particularly, for instance, for the use of torture, which was widespread. Not one single case has been brought up to court or to trial for those violations.
Porque antes de que tomara la presidencia Cerezo, los
Because right before Cerezo took office, the military officers passed the law of self-amnesty. They themselves proclaimed amnesty to their own crimes.
Y si vemos esto en una situación básica en la vida humana, como es los responsables
de la represión, this situation in something as basic and fundamental as human rights, how are we not going to doubt what's happening in the other spheres on the economic, social, and political levels?
Are you saying that the repression continues, that the disappearances continue, that torture continues?
¿Me está usted diciendo que la represión continúa, que las desapariciones continúan, que la tortura continúa?
Tal vez sin ir más lejos, según el Procurador de Derechos Humanos, del 1 de octubre al 20 de octubre de este mes, del mes pasado, se registraron en Guatemala 75 casos de secuestros. De los 75, 52 de ellos aparecieron sus cadáveres en centros públicos en Guatemala.
Just to mention
without going further, to mention one particular case. The Procurator of Human Rights, the Ombudsman in Guatemala, has said that from the 1st of October to the 20th of October, there were 75 kidnappings. Out of that, 52 bodies appeared that were taken to public centers of the government, of hospitals and morgues.
And that was in 1988.
Eso es en este año.
Sí, sí, octubre pasado.
This just this
no
last
todo
October.
El mes de octubre.
And not even the whole month of October.
O sea que, en realidad, en estos últimos tres meses, según los cálculos, los promedios en Guatemala, han habido 80 casos de secuestros y asesinatos por mes, o sea, de los últimos tres meses.
In the last three months, we have an average of 80 kidnappings and assassinations per month in Guatemala.
Aparte de la población herida, o sea, que se escapa de los secuestradores o la gente que fue atentado contra su seguridad personal, o sea, que no se incluye dentro de estos datos.
And that doesn't even consider the cases of attempted kidnapping, for instance, people that were wounded or and was managed to flee, or just those simple attempts that did not succeed.
Todos estamos de acuerdo, tanto los observadores internacionales, pero especialmente los guatemaltecos, en que la violencia ha crecido en un porcentaje demasiado alto a partir del 11 de mayo por acá. O sea, a partir del levantamiento del ejército, la demostración de que el ejército está dispuesto a conducir la guerra de manera más violenta en el país, y que se vive realmente los años 80, 81 en Guatemala, que son muy elevados en represión.
Everyone agrees now, not only us looking at it from inside, but also international observers, that the situation in Guatemala has deteriorated enormously, particularly since the attempted coup of the 11th of May, 88. And since that coup, people can say that the situation of human rights is today like it was under the period of President Lucas Garcia, one of the most dramatic periods of persecution.
And yet you were able, as a matter of fact, both of you were able to go back to Guatemala City during 1988 for at least a brief period.
Sin embargo, se nos permitió bajar a la ciudad de Guatemala, aunque sea por un breve tiempo, ahora en el año 88.
Aunque sea con 400, con 500 policías.
Although we were received by 500 policemen at the airport.
En realidad, esto era una invitación del embajador de Guatemala ante Naciones Unidas.
First, I must clarify that our trip was due initially to an invitation that we got from the ambassador of Guatemala in Geneva to the United Nations. After a presentation that we had done condemning the violation of human rights, he launched this invitation. It is our feeling that that invitation was never for real, that it all was part of propaganda and part of the rhetoric in terms of inviting us, never expecting us to accept.
Cuando nosotros aceptamos la invitación, primero recibimos las declaraciones del alto mando.
When we had accepted and we said that we were going, we initially got the reaction from the high command of the military saying that we could not visit the country, why should we go there, including the position of President Cedezo.
Pero a par de las declaraciones muy fuertes que
not only were we hearing their positions orally in terms of what they were saying about our return, but also it's important to point out that at that moment is when the death squads, or the so-called death squads, began putting bombs in the city as a way of sending us the message. And we must all know that death squads in Guatemala do not operate in an independent way, but all death squads operate planned and coordinated by the military.
Y cuando llegamos a la capital guatemalteca, después de varias negociaciones que hubo, en realidad era desproporcionada la delegación nuestra, que somos cuatro guatemaltecos, fuimos cuatro guatemaltecos, y la cantidad de policías que nos esperaban en Guatemala. O sea, era un claro acto de intimidación a los interlocutores y a nosotros también.
And when we effectively went to the country, the way we were received was a disproportionate act of violence. I mean, there was 500 policemen for four Guatemalans that were returning. We interpreted it as a clear act of intimidation to our return.
And some of you were in fact arrested for a while, is that right?
Y algunos de ustedes fueron arrestados por un momento.
Fuimos arrestados dos, el compañero Rolando Castillo Montalvo y yo. En realidad decía que era una una manifestación.
Two of us were detained, our compañero Dr. Rolando Castillo and myself, she says. Were detained at the airport, and this was a clear intimidation to what we could do, because I've been doing international work for quite a while, and that work is well known internationally, what we have done on behalf of human rights, but it has been censored inside of Guatemala. Very few people know about it, and this trip was to be the big opportunity for us to go and for her to explain to the people of Guatemala what the international work has been, and clearly there was an attempt to stop that from happening.
Y en realidad todo aparte del recibimiento que nos dio el gobierno todo
and el that intimidation that showed us how the situation is. Our trip was a success after the incidents of intimidation of the first day, but we clearly discovered that Guatemala does not have the political space that it says, that there's no space to hold a real serious national debate on the political situation, and there is no space for people like us to return and act publicly and politically. The army and the government want individuals to return, people individually, but when we return as a team trying to regain our position and our participation, they refused.
What is the impact of the recent sale of U.S. rifles to the Guatemalan government?
¿Cuál crees tú que es el impacto de la reciente venta de fusiles norteamericanos que se ha hecho aprobado por Estados Unidos al gobierno de Guatemala?
Sí, en primer lugar, yo creo que es muy peligroso.
Up to now, the supply of weapons to Guatemala has come from Israel. Obviously, the United States was involved, but essentially Israel was the main supplier of weapons to Guatemala. The fact that it's now switching back to the United States, we think is a switching policy, because although the United States was involved in the arms to Guatemala before, it was involved indirectly, and it was trying to keep a rather low profile. All of a sudden, the fact that the United States is willing to appear very openly linked to the Guatemala military and to the policies of the Guatemala military marks a worrisome new period. We know that the United States has its own economic and political and geopolitical interest in the region. It has, its presence has been very much felt in the region. But in the case of Guatemala in particular, we felt that the United States was trying to keep a low profile, contrary to its role in the rest of the region. And it is a big preoccupation, and we don't quite understand why at this moment, from going from a low profile, the United States is moving to a direct involvement in the case of Guatemala.
What do you think U.S. policy toward Guatemala should be?
¿Qué crees tú que debe ser la política de Estados Unidos hacia Guatemala?
Sí, en primer lugar creo que el gobierno norteamericano debe aceptar que los pueblos, no solo guatemaltecos, sino los pueblos centroamericanos y latinoamericanos, tenemos derecho de elegir el sistema político o la vida.
I think it's very important to the United States to recognize that the time has come for the self-determination of the peoples of Central America and Latin America. What's really important is the United States understand that the peoples in Central America have the absolute legitimate right to choose the government and style and system of government that they please. That is, that system of government they will build through their own struggles. This is the case in this century, not only of Central America, but of all Latin America. It's a struggle for our dignity. The dignity of being independent nations, choosing for ourselves what is our future and what is what we want to do of our country.
Somos pueblos independientes. Somos países. O sea que la política de Estados Unidos debe ser de respeto hacia nuestros pueblos y no de imposición hacia nuestros pueblos.
We think the policies of the United States should be a policy of respect toward our peoples and not of imposition.
Que es normalmente lo que viven los centroamericanos. o los latinoamericanos, y que en este momento incluso las luchas antipolítica norteamericana han nacido justamente porque nuestros pueblos cada vez han tenido conciencia de esta situación.
It is that policy of respect that should substitute the policy of arbitrariness and imposition over our peoples, because that's why our struggles are internal struggles, but also struggles against the mandates of United States, because it is very clear that in Latin America the population is growing in consciousness of where the origin of the problems are and who is actually imposing things on them.
Y en realidad, si vemos solo la ayuda militar como la relación de Estados Unidos en Centroamérica o la presencia.
We can see this with the aspect of military aid and military assistance that has gone to Guatemala, supporting obviously the military that has done awful things to us. But not only is it in military aid or assistance that one can notice the role of the United States in Guatemala, but in Guatemala there's another phenomenon, the massive influx of fundamentalist Christian churches with enormous amount of money, with a very defined political agenda in their mind. We see this as part of the U.S. tactics as well. We see this as part of the sort of U.S. aggression against the country, sort of overshadowed by a veneer of religion, but with a definite political purpose.
Would you say that the army and the government are racist in their attitudes toward the Indian population?
¿Dirías tú que el ejército y el gobierno han sido racistas en su política hacia la población?
Sí, en realidad lo que le ha preocupado al gobierno es que casi el 70% de la población, que somos indígenas, hemos ido reclamando participación política, participación económica en los últimos años. Y como la represión, la discriminación ha sido tan grande durante 500 años en Guatemala, no iba a ser posible que los indígenas en este momento fueran parte de la situación política en el país. Las masacres han destruido comunidades completas. Las torturas se han hecho con mujeres indígenas embarazadas y más crueles todavía que en el resto de la población. O sea que sí hay una mentalidad racista, discriminatoria, que se refleja en los actos de represión del ejército.
The answer is yes. You see, the problem for the government and the army at this moment is that we, the Indian population, she says, that represents 70% of the people of Guatemala, all of a sudden are growing in consciousness about our rights and are demanding and struggling. And this is something they can't understand, because after 500 years of oppression and discrimination, it is unacceptable for them that all of a sudden the Indians want to become equals in the society and demand their full participation. So because of that, there has been a systematic policy of repression. And you notice it in the way the army carried the repression. Although repression is generalized in the country, in Indian villages, they have really done horrendous things. They have killed children, they have killed women. We've seen cases of women that are pregnant being tortured by the military with a tremendous degree of ferocity and brutality. All this is proof that yes, for the army, there is a very basic racist perspective when they commit genocide in a village in the highlands, in the Indian highlands of the country.
How can peace come to your country?
¿Cómo crees tú que la paz puede llegar algún día a tu país?
Sí, en realidad hay varias alternativas que el mismo pueblo de Guatemala la está haciendo.
At this moment, the mass movement, the popular organizations and the church are really pushing very strongly to force the national dialogue. Not only the national dialogue of reconciliation, but also the dialogue between the government and the insurgent movement, the URNG, to achieve peace in the country. Because although we think that this national dialogue is a first step and won't necessarily bring immediate solutions to the country, we do think it's a very important first step that can begin pointing to the way to bring about peace in the country.
Sobre todo cuando el movimiento popular demanda una serie de respuestas concretas a las necesidades más urgentes de sobrevivencia. Y luego los efectos del conflicto interno son cada vez más altos. Ha sido enorme, enorme la cantidad en vidas humanas, de represión, de inseguridad, de control militar. Por lo tanto, es urgente que todos los sectores del pueblo guatemalteco participen en la solución del problema.
Especially at this moment when the popular organizations, the poor sectors, are demanding very concrete, specific response to their very basic needs, but also because the internal armed conflict has already cost too many lives, thousands of Guatemalans killed, and the cost is still escalating. Everyone feels the pressure to see and look for a solution, but a solution that would incorporate the participation of all sectors of the Guatemalan society in achieving it.
If the army has effective power in the country, how would it possibly agree to the kind of reconciliation that you're talking about?
Si el ejército tiene ese poder tan efectivo en todo el país que se ha mencionado, ¿cómo puede hacerse que el ejército llegue a aceptar las propuestas que tú has hecho?
Sí, en realidad, porque la fuerza del pueblo guatemalteco.
You must remember that there's a lot of forces active in Guatemala. For instance, Guatemala has an armed internal conflict, which is growing and challenging the military. That the popular organizations and the mass movement is also growing in terms of strength and their demands and their struggle. So it's very clear that here is an enormous potential of force coming out from this population that will grow as the ties between them and as they unite and they build those bridges between the different forces. This is an enormous force that even Cerezo could have taken advantage of. Cerezo would have really had a good intentions in the country. He could have backed his initiatives to transform Guatemala with the support of the people, but he didn't. He played the role that the military had designed for him and became just an issue of legitimacy. And we think it is this strength that will eventually weaken the grip of the military.
O sea que, en realidad, solo hablemos del sector campesino. El ejército tiene tanto miedo, por ejemplo, al caso del CUC, el Comité de Unidad Campesina. ¿Por qué? Porque son 6 millones de guatemaltecos que necesitan vivir de la tierra. Por lo tanto, lo enfrenta con mucha represión, pero sobre todo con mucho temor. Y si hablamos de todos los sectores populares, más el condimento de conflicto interno que cada vez ha crecido, si vemos los resultados de los enfrentamientos en las áreas de conflicto, son bastante grandes y deja claro que existe un estado de guerra en Guatemala. De guerra no declarada, pero en Guatemala sí es declarada, en tanto que hay zonas de guerra.
Let's talk about one specific concrete case, the case of the campesinos. Why does the army fear so much the legalization of my organization, the CUC, the Comunidad de Unidad Campesina? Well, because Guatemala is an agricultural country where you have 6 million campesinos. So of course the army is fearful of this amount of people. And the repression to that sector should be seen as a sign of fear. The army represses because they're afraid of the strength that the campesino movement is growing. But if you tie that to the struggle of other sectors, the mass movement, and you tie also this to this increase in armed struggle, to the fact that although there's not an internationally declared war, but that clearly internally there is a war, and there are war zones in Guatemala, the army is getting very nervous. Because if you analyze the amount of casualties they're suffering, they're in a very difficult situation in those precise zones of conflict.
Y como dije anteriormente, en realidad, el intento de diálogo o para llegar a una solución pacífica, a crear la paz sobre la base de la justicia en Guatemala.
That's why it is through the pressure of the population demanding a national dialogue that we think that we can build peace based on justice in Guatemala. That is only through this pressure. Pressure that should come from inside Guatemala with the participation of all sectors in this coalition, but also that should come from out of Guatemala at the same time. Pressure from the international community to help us achieve this dialogue and this peace. For instance, the International, the World Declaration of Human Rights, it is an important document that states what are the human rights of all the peoples and all the individuals in the world. But those human rights are only respected not only by the declaration, which is important, but also by the struggle of the people in each country that are demanding that those rights be fulfilled and respected. And it's that combination of the international community and the pressures we can build inside that will make a difference.
Let me ask you, what would happen if Guatemalan politics were transformed and the left came to power the way it was in power in 1954 before the coup? Would the United States government have anything to fear from such a government in Guatemala?
Yo creo que nuestros pueblos han sido tan humildes, y especialmente en Guatemala, que la gran mayoría de la población son indígenas, con una cultura tan rica, con una herencia de los mayas tan avanzada en el pasado, pero sobre todo tan viva en este momento. Una razón, un modo de interpretar la vida tan humana. En realidad, si se dejaran nuestros pueblos, que ellos sean las que eligen esa forma y dar continuidad a esa forma de vivir, creo que ningún pueblo del mundo debería de tener miedo a nuestros pueblos. Incluso deberían de admirarlos por los sentimientos tan humanas y tan buenas que tiene nuestra gente.
I come from a very humble nation, she says, a nation typified by Indian peoples. And if one can analyze the richness, the importance that it is for us to base ourselves in that Indian identity, the Mayan, the tradition of the Mayan culture that became so great in the past, but the more importantly of the past is that it's so much alive in the present, that it's so much part of our daily life, and what that means in terms of our identity, our philosophy, our way of seeing things, that when we consider the possibility of selecting our own government, a government that could not only respect that identity but could also develop, it could also give an alternative to our nation to express itself as a different nation, as a nation marked by a tradition and a strong ethnic identity, one does not understand how any nation in the world could feel threatened by that. As a matter of fact, we think that any country in the world should feel happy about this, about the growth of a country with a particular defined identity in which our Indian culture will raise and develop the sort of trust, honorability, and friendship that is very characteristic of the Indian peoples.
O sea que yo creo que la lucha que se vive en Guatemala es la combinación de la gran necesidad de ser parte de los de tener lo necesario para sobrevivir o para vivir, o sea, la educación, la salud, o sea, ser parte de las luchas económicas, políticas, sociales, pero al mismo tiempo es una combinación de la lucha por la identidad de los pueblos indígenas, porque los indígenas tengamos los mismos derechos en nuestra patria y que nuestra cultura podamos desarrollarla. En realidad, esos son dos elementos, la lucha económica, política, social y la lucha cultural, hace que Guatemala, la lucha del pueblo guatemalteco es muy particular, incluso en Centroamérica, pero también a nivel internacional, o sea, muy particular, y yo creo que el cambio que se va a dar en Guatemala no puede excluir uno y otro, tiene que ser la combinación de ambas reivindicaciones.
In the case of Guatemala, we feel that we have two different types of struggle. Our very legitimate struggle for our basic needs, economic, social, and political needs, just to survive economically and to be able to feed our families. That struggle is there. That struggle is a major immediate necessity. But in a country like ours, you also have to understand that there's another struggle, the struggle for the rights of identity, the struggle for the rights of our people. And both struggles have to be taken into consideration. It is for the indigenous population of Guatemala extremely important that breaking the tradition of history, at any given moment they will have the chance to be equal in that society, be full participants in terms of the identity and the development of citizens, giving a new character to that nation. and also giving a new alternative of survival for that rich culture.
What is the impact of... In May of 1993, the Guatemalan Constitution was suspended. You're watching Alternative Views, our 499th program. Well, I see we have time for some more news stories from the Alternative Press.
There's a new magazine on the U.S. scene now. It's called Third Force, Issues and Actions in Communities of Color. They're a publication by the Center for Third World Organizing out of Oakland, California, and they're going to emphasize the internal colonialism in the U.S., where government policies are enabling corporations and government institutions to basically interfere in the organizing efforts and neighborhoods of people of color within our own shores. They have a very good story in their premier issue, which came out for March and April of 93, called Low Expectations for Our New Secretary of Energy. This is part of a larger article called Nuking Native America, where they outline how Clinton appointee Hazel O'Leary led the fight to increase nuclear waste storage at the Prairie Island Nuclear Facility at the Midwakanton Sioux Reservation in Minnesota. O'Leary, who's now going to be our Secretary of Energy, did this while serving as a vice president at Northern States Power Company. Why is it that government appointees always come out of the business world anyway? Why can't we see an environmentalist or a consumer activist there?
Well, that's the power structure at work. They're not going to put anybody who's going to do anything to harm the system.
Why not Ralph Nader? Something like that.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, apparently O'Leary sought a permit to allow an additional 287 tons of nuclear waste to be stored at the site in Minnesota. Over the intense opposition of the tribe and even common sense, the area where the waste is to be stored was underwater during a recent flood and sits on top of a major fault line. Prairie Island itself has been fraught with the mismanagement, or rather the Prairie Island facility has been fraught with the mismanagement typical of the nuclear industry, and last spring came within minutes of suffering a three-mile island-like disaster. Minnesota's own Department of Health estimates that the local population will have an additional 6 deaths per 100,000 as a consequence of the extra storage, but Leary's been undeterred by this. In fact, she managed to get the site approved. During her testimony last year before the Senate, she also affirmed her commitment to nuclear power in the U.S., but remarked sensibly that the waste issue must be solved if the industry is to survive. But if her record in Minnesota is an indicator of what her solutions are like, then we can look forward to more hastily made decisions at the expense of the weakest elements of our society, especially with regard to where nuclear waste facilities are going to go.
Sue Kim now has an article from In These Times, which talks about how the new capitalism, which the Yeltsin and his boys in Russia are trying to achieve, how it has affected women, and particularly women in the workplace. I mean, back in the Soviet Union, everybody had a job, even all the women. But things are changing in the Soviet Union, aren't they?
75 years after the revolution resulted in equality between the sexes, Russian women find themselves being prodded toward a giant leap backward. Until recently, women comprised 51% of the workforce and 60% of all Soviet workers with higher education. But today, they're being urged, brainwashed, and legislated back to their pre-modern status as homemakers and mothers. The rationale is that in a declining labor market, available jobs are needed by men. The state can no longer afford the massive outlays it once invested in a universal network of daycare centers, maternity leaves, child nutrition programs, and other measures designed to support a population of working mothers. Asked recently about the alarming growth of joblessness among women, the Russian labor minister demanded, "Why should we employ women when men are unemployed?" According to the labor minister, Russian women were regrettably forced to become workers during Soviet times as part of an extensive strategy to develop the economy. But now, the Yeltsin government's message to women is stark and brutal. Get back to the kitchen and quick. Officially, unemployment in Russia remains comparatively low at around 1 million people, or barely 1% of the workforce. Of the current registered jobless in Russia, over 70% are women. At Moscow's government-run employment bureau, 8 out of every 10 applicants are female, the majority of them middle-aged and highly educated. 2 years ago, the average Soviet woman earned roughly 70% of what the average male made, but today that figure is down to 40%. According to the Women's Union of Russia, the majority of Russians immediately facing the acts of unemployment are women between the ages of 35 and 50. For younger women, a somewhat different set of hurdles exists. There is work in new commercial structures for secretaries, clerks, and salespeople, but women who want those jobs often encounter intense and open sexual harassment. Employees demand young and attractive women. Often they are urged to appear for the interview wearing sexy clothes. One ads frequently stipulate that BK girls only need apply, a code meaning without inhibitions. And the Russian media has enthusiastically embraced the campaign to drive women back into traditional, subservient, and dependent roles. As yet, there is very little organized opposition to the backlash. Feminist leaders note that Russian women appear to be bending their backs and accepting their fates.
The government and the media just don't know what to do about the ex-Soviet Union. They really crowed about the fact that communism failed and now capitalism is going to come in and really going to show those people what they've been missing all these years. Well, they found out what they've been missing all these years. Unemployment and all kinds of things that go along with capitalism. You remember IMF advisors flocked to Moscow to help them out and try to take over their economy. I haven't heard too much about them. Well, the economy is a mess, according to an In These Times editorial. And also, the Russians aren't too keen on capitalism. Even New York Times reported that the American-style capitalism, the Russians now realize, means higher prices, less individual security, more unemployment, less social justice, and greed and crime. Matter of fact, a poll that was taken back in 1992 showed that the Russians, only 46% of the Russians agreed that Marxism was bankrupt. And only 11% thought that it wasn't. But 44% also believed that capitalism wasn't the answer, against 19% who thought it was. Well, so what is the answer? Well, the answer is there is none. For 70 years, the Russians had been operating without the complexity of capitalism and democracy, all the public forums, the monopoly capitalism, the small capitalism, all the various free trade unions, very organizations which will actually function in a democracy and in capitalism. Now, they did enjoy, however, the traditionally good things that go along with socialism, like guaranteed employment, free medical help, free housing or low-cost housing, free education. But under the stifling conformity of bureaucracy, they just sat there and did their work, and that was it. Now, they're beginning a process that took 200 years in the United States to develop and over 350 in England. Yeltsin, of course, has been a disaster. Production has fallen 40%. Fear and insecurity, increasing poverty, prostitution, crime is rampant. It's pretty terrible. There have been some elections which give a kind of mixed feeling about what the people are doing. For instance, in April of 1993, five local elections scattered around Russia, hardline communists won. No one was elected in two other contests because they couldn't get the required number of votes. Nobody could. And in a tiny farming republic in the Caspian Sea, the voters chose a young capitalist tycoon who promised that he would ban all political parties and impose an economic dictatorship just to ensure prosperity. So there's no opposition to speak of. It's diverse. It's ineffective. The Yeltsin is ineffective. Things are a real mess.
I have some information from Daniel Singer, who published an article in The Nation, Our Man in Moscow, on May the 10th of this year. And he documented the tremendous crisis of the Russian economy under Boris Yeltsin and the tremendously positive media that Yeltsin has gotten in the West, particularly the United States, and the strong support he's gotten from the Clinton administration. First of all, Singer points out that it's Yeltsin's policies that are responsible for the steady collapse of the Russian economy. The prices, according to the calculations of Yeltsin and his group, were supposed to rise, to increase by approximately threefold over the past year. Actually, they rose more than 20-fold. People's entire savings were wiped out. Wages could not keep pace. Industrial output fell by a fifth, and living standards by a third. At least one-third of the Russian population is now living below the subsistence level. But basically, Yeltsin's reforms have been given good press in the West because he has allowed U.S. firms and other Western European firms to come over and take over enterprises in the Soviet Union at a real cheap price. In other words, selling off at a cheap bargain some of the Russian state property. And since this is good for American capitalism, therefore the American media and the Clinton administration has been very favorable to Yeltsin. The press in the U.S. and the Clinton administration has also presented Yeltsin as the good Democrat and his People's Congress as a bunch of old commies who are obstructionists and who are really responsible for the political impasse that the Russians are in. Well, this disregards the fact, according to Daniel Singer, that it was the wicked Congress that's being attacked that selected the Supreme Soviet that named Yeltsin president, that passed the laws that enabled him to be elected president of the Russian Republic through universal suffrage, and that initially supported Yeltsin's programs and is only criticizing them when it's obviously that they are failing. Moreover, there hasn't been that much coverage over the extent to which Yeltsin attempted to subvert Soviet democracy. In early April, he said, "Today I signed a decree on a special regime and explained that parliamentary opposition to his will would be declared null and void." In other words, he said, "I'm the boss, and anything that the parliament does is irrelevant." Then, once this anti-constitutional coup failed because the entirety of the Russian Congress and most of the Russian people revolted against it, Yeltsin backtracked, and when he finally released the decree that had supposedly abolished Congress, he was published without the incriminating passage, as if he hadn't really intended this in the first place.
Who knows what's going to happen? Capitalism certainly was no white knight who's going to come in and yell, "Hi-ho, silver," and solve everything.
And that's Alternative Views for this time. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'd like to thank our crew for helping the program, Brian Lynch, Eric Eubank, and Kevin L. West. We're our central people for our news sections, along with Rosalind Peacock, Catherine Galatera, Sue Kim, Roger Neusenblatt, Maria Lopez, and Joel May. We're particularly indebted to James Walsh from Tampa, Florida, who let us use his interview with Senora Menchu. We also are very appreciative of Chris Burke, who sent us his incredible audio tape entitled "The Oil War." His associate producer was Saul Streit, and Austin's Kirk Hunter provided the video. If you're interested in hearing the total tape, all of it, write to Arrest Records, and the name is Oil War, 201 East 87th Street, Suite 22P, New York, New York, 10128. Alternative Views is a presentation of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Bye.